his fall. All the while that the elves had fought at Baen Draw and on the long march home again, Andur Elicidal had waited for his father to wake, refusing to believe that he would not. But the king had not regained consciousness, and now it seemed that perhaps he would not do so ever. The elven prince understood that, accepted it, and thus looked past it to what must then be. "Elven lords," he finished, his voice worn and empty, "I am my father's son, and I know what is expected of a prince of the elves. The elven army has come out of the Serendanon, and now must stand here. I intend to stand with it. I intend to lead it. I would not have it so if there were any way that this moment could be undone, if all that had happened within these past few weeks might be wiped from the record of our lives. But that cannot be. Were my father here, you would rally to him, to a man, I know that. I stand then in my father's place and ask that you rally to me, for I am the last of his blood. These men who stand with me have given me their support. I seek yours as well. Pledge me that support, elven lords." Wordlessly he waited. He need not have asked for their support, he knew, but merely assumed it. His was the power of the Elicidal rule, and there were few who would dare to challenge that. He could have asked Alanon to speak for him. The druid's voice alone might have silenced any opposition. Yet Andur wanted no one to intercede for him in this, nor did he wish to take anything for granted. The support of the High Council and of the Outlanders who had come to give them aid should be won over by what they might see in him, not by fear or any claim of right that did not ground itself squarely on whatever strength of character he had shown in his command of the elven army since the moment that his father had fallen. Emer Chios came to his feet. His dark eyes swept briefly over the faces of those assembled. Then he turned to Andur. "My lord prince," his deep voice rumbled, "all who gather in this council know that I follow no man blindly, even though he be of royal blood and the child of kings. I have said often and publicly that I trust the judgment of my people better than the judgment of any one man, though he be king of all the known world." He looked about him slowly. "Yet I am Eventine Elicidal's faithful minister and his great admirer. He is a king, elven lords, as a king was meant to be. I wish that he were here to lead us in this most dangerous time. But he is not. His son offers himself in his place. I know Andur Elicidal. I think I know him as well as any. I have listened to him. I have judged him by his words and by his acts and by what he has shown himself to be. I say now that in the absence of the king there is no man to whom I would more willingly entrust the safety of my homeland and my life than he." He paused, then carefully placed his right hand over his heart. The elven pledge of loyalty. There was a moment's silence. Then others rose with him from the table, a few at first, then all, hands placed across their hearts as they faced the prince. The commanders of the elven army stepped forward as well. Elrante, dour-faced and bluff, who after the death of Pindannon ranked highest in command. Kobold, the tall, immaculately dressed captain of the Black Watch, and Karin, commanding the Home Guard. In moments, all of the elves who had assembled within the High Council stood facing their prince, hands lifted in salute. At Andur Elicidal's side, a dark figure leaned close. "Now they follow you, elven prince," Alanon spoke softly. Andur nodded. He could almost regret that it was so. They talked then of the defense of Arbelan. Preparations for that defense had begun almost immediately following the departure of the elven army to the Serendanon 2 weeks earlier. Aemir Chios, as ruler of the home city in the king's absence, had convened the High Council, together with the commanders of the elven army who had not accompanied the king, for the purpose of deciding what steps should be taken to protect Arbelan in the event the demons broke out of the Serendanon. A series of carefully drawn defensive measures had been settled upon. The First Minister reviewed them now with Ander. There were but two approaches to the city. From the east, along the trails that ran through the Valley of Wren and the forests beyond, and from the west, out of the Serendanon. North and south of Arbelan stood mountains that offered no passage, tall peaks that shut away the lowland woods and ringed the Carolan in a wall of rock. Alanon had warned that the break in the forbidding would come in the Hoar Flats. That meant the demons must come east through the Serendanon, and unless they turned north or south to bypass the mountains sheltering Arbelan, a march that would consume at least several days' additional time, the attack on the elven home city would come from the west. Yet it was here that the elven defenses were strongest. Two natural barriers would immediately confront the demons. First was the Rillsong, somewhat narrow where it arced eastward below the Carolan, but deep and difficult to navigate in the best weather. Second was the bluff itself, a sheer cliff that rose more than 400 feet to its summit, its stone face split by a web of deep crevices and choked with scrub and heavy brush. A single bridge spanned the Rillsong below the Carolan, at a point where the channel narrowed. There were no shallows for miles in either direction. The Elfich provided the primary access route to the Carolan, although a series of smaller stairways wound upward through wooded sections of the cliff further south. The defense of Arbelan depended then upon the river and the bluff. It had been decided that the bridge spanning the Rillsong would be destroyed immediately upon the return of the elven army. This had been done as planned, Chios pointed out, and the last link between Arbelan and the Serendanon had been severed. On the east bank, the elves had anchored hundreds of pitch-burning stanchions to give light in the event a night crossing should be attempted, and they had constructed a stone and earthen redoubt almost at the edge of the Rillsong that ran for several hundred yards along the riverbank at the base of the bluff and arced backward into the cliff face at either side of the Elfich. The east bank extended back from the river about 200 feet to the cliffs, and most of this ground was wooded and grown thick with scrub. Here the elves had set dozens of traps and pitfalls to ensnare any demons who sought to flank the redoubt. But it was the Elfich that provided the major defense to Arbelan. All of the smaller stairways leading to the great tableland of the Carolan had been destroyed. All that remained was the Elfich. 7 stone block ramps and iron-bound gates that ran upward from the base of the bluff to the heights. Battlements ringed each gate to close off passage to the gates and ramps above it. Each ramp and gate was set back slightly from the ones below, and as the Elfich rose toward the heights, it spiraled upward in a series of evenly measured turns that permitted each successive gate and ramp to offer some measure of protection through the use of longbows and darts to the gates and ramps beneath. In times of peace, the gates to the 7 ramps stood open. The battlements were left undefended but for a token watch, and the ancient stone grew thick with flowering vines. But now, with the retreat of the elven army from the Serendanon, the ramparts bristled with elven pikes and lances, and the gates stood locked and barred. No defenses had been constructed atop the Carolan. The plateau ran back to the deep forest in a broad, rolling plain spotted with woods, isolated cottages, and the solitary closure of the Gardens of Life. East, within the fringe of the forest trees, stood Arbelan. If the demons were successful in reaching the Carolan, the choices left to the defending elves were few. If enough of them remained, they might stand upon the plain in an attempt to sweep the invaders over the cliff edge. Failing that, they would be forced to fall back to the Valley of Wren, there to fight one final battle or face being driven from the Westland altogether. Chios paused in his report. Of course, if they bypass the mountains and come in from the east, he began. Alanon cut him short. They will not. Time becomes important to them now. They will come from the west. Ander glanced questioningly at Stee Jans, but the Free Corps commander merely shrugged. Ander turned back to Amer Chios. What are the news, First Minister? Mixed news, I'm afraid, regarding our request to the other lands for aid. Callahorn has sent us another 250 horse. Old Guard, the Legion's regular army. There is a vague promise of some additional aid to come, though no indication as to how soon we might expect it. Our messenger reports that the members of the Council of the Cities have not yet been able to resolve the differences over what the extent of Callahorn's involvement in this elven war should be, and the king has chosen not to intervene. It appears that sending the Old Guard command was basically another compromise solution. The matter is still under debate, but we have heard nothing more. As Stee Jans had warned, Ander thought darkly. The Federation has sent a message as well, my Lord Prince. Chios's smile was bitter. A message that is brief and to the point, I might add. It is the policy of the Federation that it not become involved in the affairs of other lands and other races. If a threat to others touches upon the sovereignty of its own states, the Federation will act. As matters stand now, that does not appear to be the case. Therefore, until the situation changes, no aid will be forthcoming. He shrugged. Not altogether unexpected. And the Kershaw, Ander asked quickly. What of the trolls? Chios shook his head. Nothing. I took the liberty of dispatching another messenger. Ander nodded his approval. And the dwarves?
We're here, a rough voice answered. Some of us, at least.
A bearded, thick-set dwarf made his way forward through the men gathered about the council table. Quick blue eyes blinked through a face that was weathered and browned by the sun, and a pair of gnarled hands fastened on the table's edge.
Druid.
The dwarf nodded briefly to Alanon, then turned to Ander.
My name is Browark, elder and citizen of Cullhaven. I've brought 100 sappers to the service of the Illicitals. You can thank the druid for that. He found us some weeks ago at work on a bridge crossing the Silver River and warned us of the danger. Alanon is known to the dwarves, so there were no questions asked. We sent word to Cullhaven and came on ahead. 10 days' march and a hard march at that. But we're here.
He extended his hand and Ander shook it warmly.
What of the others, Browark? Alanon asked.
The dwarf nodded rather impatiently.
On their way by now, I presume. You should have an army of several thousand by week's end.
He gave Alanon a disapproving frown.
In the meantime, you've got us, Druid, and mighty lucky you are to have us. No one but the sappers could have rigged that ramp.
The Elfich, Chios explained quickly to a puzzled Ander. Browark and his sappers have been working with us on our defenses. In the process of studying the Elfich, he saw that it was possible to rig the fifth ramp to collapse.
Child's play.
Browark dismissed the accomplishment with a wave of his hand. We undercut the stone block, removed the secondary supports, then split the primary with iron wedges fixed to chains. The chains we concealed in the brush beneath the ramp ran them to the heights and lined them to a system of pulleys. If the demons reach the fifth ramp, just draw in the chains, slip the wedges, and the whole ramp from the fifth gate down falls away. Simple.
Simple if you have the engineering skill of a dwarf sapper, I think.
Ander smiled. Well done, Browark. We have need of you.
There are others here that you need as well.
Alanon put his hand on Ander's shoulder and pointed to the far end of the council table. The elven prince turned. A lone elf dressed all in leather stepped forward and placed his hand across his heart in the pledge of loyalty.
"Deign, my lord prince," the elf said quietly, "I am a wing rider."
"A wing rider?" Anders stared at the elf in surprise. He had heard stories from his father of the people who called themselves the Sky Elves, stories almost forgotten by most, for no wing rider had come to Arbalon in the last 100 years.
"How many of you are there?" he asked finally.
5, Deign replied. "There would be more but for the fear of a demon attack on the Winghove, our own home city. My father has sent those of us who are here. We are all of one family. My father is called Herol."
He paused and glanced at Alanon. "There was a time when the druid and he were friends."
"We are still friends, Wing Rider," Alanon said quietly.
Deign acknowledged the druid's commitment with a nod, then returned his gaze to Ander.
"My father's sense of kinship with the land elves is stronger than that of most of his countrymen, my lord prince, for most have long since broken all ties with the old ways and the old rule, and my father knows that Alanon stands with the Illicitals, and that has meaning. Thus he sends us. He would be here himself but for the absence of his rock genuine, who trains with my brother's son so that he may one day be a wing rider as was his father. Still, those of us who are here may be of some use. We can fly the whole of the Westland skies if need be. We can seek out the demons who threaten and tell you of their movements. We can spy out strengths and weaknesses. That much, at least, we can offer."
"That much we accept with gratitude, Deign." Ander returned the wing rider's salute. "Be welcome." Deign bowed and stepped back. Ander glanced at Chios.
"Are there any others come to stand with us, First Minister?"
Chios shook his head slowly.
"No, my lord prince. These are all."
Ander nodded.
"Then these will be enough."
He motioned for all who were gathered to seat themselves with him at the council table, and a general discussion ensued on such matters as soldier placement, weapons distribution, battle tactics, and the taking of additional defensive measures. Reports were heard from Elrond Tay on the elven hunters of the regular army, from Karen on the home guard, and from Kobold of the Black Watch. Browerk gave his assessment of the overall structural efficiency of the elven defenses, and Stee Jans was consulted on strategies that might be implemented to offset the superior strength of the demon hordes. Even Deign spoke briefly on the fighting capabilities of the rocks and their uses in aerial combat. Time slipped past rapidly, and the night drifted away. Ander grew light-headed with fatigue, and his thoughts began to wander. It was in the middle of one of these wanderings that a tremendous crash jerked him upright as the doors of the High Council flew open and a disheveled Gale appeared, flanked by the chamber guards. Breathless, the little elf rushed forward and dropped to his knee before Ander.
"My lord," he gasped, his face flushed with excitement. "My lord, the king is awake."
Ander stared.
"Awake?"
Then he was on his feet and sprinting from the chamber. While he slept, it felt to Eventine Illicital as if he were floating through a blackness layered with gossamer threads that wrapped his body in a seamless blanket. One by one, he felt the threads enfold him, mold about him, join with him. Time and space were nothing. There was only the blackness and the weave of the threads. It was a warm, pleasant sensation at first, much like the feel to an infant of a mother's close embrace, filled with comfort and love. But then the embrace seemed to tighten, and he began to suffocate. Desperately, he struggled to break free and found that he could not. He began to sink downward through the blackness, spinning slowly, his blanket a shroud, and he no longer a creature of life,
but one of death. Terrified, he thrashed within his silken prison, tearing and ripping at its fabric until, with a sudden rending, it flew apart and was gone. His eyes opened. Light blinded him momentarily, harsh and flickering. He blinked in its glare, disoriented and confused, fighting to gain some sense of where he was and what he was doing. Then the outlines of a room began to gather form, and he recognized the smell of oil lamps and the feel of cotton sheets and woolen blankets wrapped close about his body. All that had happened in the moments before he slept came back again in a rush, images that ran mad and disjointed across his mind. The brake line, Halas cut, and the demons attacking from out of the deep mist. Lines of elven archers, lancers, and pikemen spread out below him. Cries of pain and death. Dark forms hurtling toward him through a wall of blue fire. Alanon, Ander, the glint of weapons, then a sudden blow. He twitched violently beneath the covers, and sweat bathed his body. The room sharpened abruptly before his eyes. It was his sleeping room in the manor house in Arbalon, and there was a figure moving toward him.
"My lord!"
Gale's frightened voice sounded in his ear, and the youthful face bent down close to his own.
"My lord, are you awake?"
"What has happened?" he muttered, his own voice thick and barely recognizable.
"You were wounded, my lord, at Halas Cut. A blow struck here."
The elf pointed to the king's left temple.
"You have been unconscious ever since. My lord, we were so worried."
"How long have I slept?" he interrupted. His hand reached to touch his head, and the pain laced downward through his neck.
7 days, my lord.
7 days. Gale started back away.
"I will bring your son, my lord."
His mind whirled.
"My son?" "Prince Ander, my lord."
His aide dashed toward the sleeping room door.
"He meets now with the High Council. Lie back. I will bring him at once."
Eventine watched him wrench open the door, heard him talk briefly with someone beyond, then watched the door close again, leaving him in silence. He tried to raise himself, but the effort was too much, and he fell back weakly.
Ander?
Had Gale said that Ander was meeting with the High Council? Where was Arion? Doubt clouded his thoughts, and the questions came in a flurry. What was he doing here in Arbalon? What had befallen the army of the elves? What had become of their defense of the Serendanon? Again he tried to raise himself, and again fell back. A wave of nausea swept through him. He felt suddenly old, as if the number of his years was a sickness that had wasted him. His jaw tightened. Oh, that he might have back again 5 minutes of his youth to give him strength enough to rise from this bed. Anger and determination fired him, and he inched himself upward against his pillows until he lay propped against them, breathing raggedly. Across the room, Manx raised his grizzled head. The king opened his mouth to call out to the old wolfhound, but suddenly the dog's eyes met his, and the words died in his throat. There was hate in those eyes, hate so cold that it cut through Eventine like a winter frost. He blinked in disbelief, fighting the sense of repulsion that welled up within him. Manx? What was he thinking? He forced himself to look away, to stare elsewhere in the sleeping room, at walls and their hangings, at furniture, and at the drapes drawn tight against the windows. Desperately he tried to compose himself and could not. "I am alone," he thought suddenly, unreasonably, and was filled with fear. "Alone?" He glanced back again at Manx. The wolfhound's eyes fixed him, veiled now, hiding what had been so evident before. Or had he imagined it?
He watched as the old dog rose, turned about, and lay down again. "Why does he not come to me?" the king asked himself. "Why does he not come?" He slipped back against the pillows. "What am I saying?" The words whispered in his mind, and he saw the madness that threatened to slip across him. Seeing hatred in the eyes of an animal that had been faithful to him for years? Seeing in Manx an enemy that might do him harm? What was wrong with him? Voices sounded in the outer corridor. Then the sleeping room door opened and closed again, and Ander crossed the room to reach down and hold him close. The king hugged his son to him, then broke the clasp, searching Ander's shadowed face as the prince seated himself on the edge of the bed. "Tell me what has happened," Eventine ordered softly. Then he saw something flicker in his son's eyes, and he felt a sudden chill pass through him. He forced the question from his lips. "Where is Arion?" Ander opened his mouth to speak, then stared at the old man wordlessly. Eventine's face froze. "Is he dead?" Ander's voice was a whisper. "At Warrel Run." He seemed to search for something more to say, then gave up, shaking his head slowly. Eventine's eyes filled with tears, and his hands shook as he grasped his son's arms. "Arion is dead?" He spoke the words as if they were a lie. Ander nodded, then looked away. "Kael Pendennon, too." There was a moment of stunned silence. The king's hands fell away. "And the Serendanon?"
"Lost."
They stared at each other wordlessly, father and son, as if some frightening secret had been shared that should never have been told. Then Ander reached down and clasped his father to him. For long moments they held each other in silence. When at last the king spoke, his voice was flat and distant. "Tell me about Arion. Everything. Leave nothing out." Ander told him. Quietly he related how his brother had died, how they had brought him out of the break line to the Serendanon, and how they had buried him at Bay and Draw. Then he spoke of all that had befallen the army of the elves from that first day of battle at Halys Cut through the long march back to Arbalon. Eventine listened and said nothing. When Ander had finished, he stared blankly at the flicker of the oil lamps for a moment. Then his eyes shifted to his son.
"I want you to return to the High Council, Ander. Do what must be done."
He paused, his voice breaking.
"Go on."
"I will be all right." Ander looked at him uncertainly.
"I can ask Gael to come in."
The king shook his head.
"No. Not now.
I just want to..." He stopped, choking back what he was about to say, one hand gripping his son's arm tightly.
"I am very proud of you, Ander. I know how difficult..."
Ander nodded, his throat tightening. He placed his father's hands within his own.
"Gael will be outside in the hall when you need him."
He rose and started toward the door. His hand was on the latch when Eventine called out after him, his voice strangely anxious.
"Take Manx out with you."
Ander stopped, looked at the old wolfhound, whistled him to his side, and led him out. The door closed softly behind him. Alone again, this time truly alone, the king of the elves lay back upon the cushion of his pillows and let the enormity of all that had happened wash over him. In a little more than 7 days, the finest army in the four lands had been driven like a herd of cattle before wolves from its own country, driven from the brake line, from the Serendanon, and all the way back to its home city, there to stand or fall. Somewhere deep within him there was a terrible sense of failure. He had let this happen. He was responsible. "Arion," he whispered suddenly, remembering. Then the tears welled up in his eyes, and he began to cry. Chapter 36. "Eretria," Will exclaimed softly, surprise and wariness in his voice. Disregarding the pain from his injury, he pushed himself up on one elbow for a closer look. "What are you doing here?" "Saving you, it would appear." She laughed, her dark eyes mischievous. Sudden movement caught his eye, and he stared past her into the shadows. Two rover women busied themselves at a sideboard near the rear of the wagon, rinsing cloths red with his blood in a basin of water. Instinctively, he reached up to his head and found that a bandage had been placed across the wound. He touched it gingerly and winced. "I wouldn't do that." Eretria brushed his hand aside. "It is the only part of you that is clean." The veilman glanced about quickly. "What have you done with Amberlee?" "Your sister," she mocked. "She is safe enough." "You will excuse me if I am a bit skeptical about that." He started to rise from the bed. "Stay, healer." She forced him down again. Her voice lowered so that the women behind her could not hear. "Do you fear I might seek revenge because of your ill-conceived decision to leave me behind at the Tearfing? Do you think so little of me?" She laughed and tossed her head. "Perhaps now, though, if you were given the chance, you would reconsider that decision. Is that possible?" "Not in the least. Now what about Amberlee?" "Had I intended harm to you, Will Ohmsford, or to her, I would have left the both of you to the cutthroats who chased you through Grimpen Ward. The elven girl is well. I will have her brought after we have talked." She turned to the women at the sideboard. "Go, leave us." The women stopped what they were doing and disappeared through a flap at the other end of the wagon. When they had gone, Eretria turned back to the veilman, her head cocked to one side. "Well, what shall I do with you now, Will Ohmsford?" He took a deep breath. "How did you find me, Eretria?" She grinned. "Easily enough. Word of your great healing power spread the length and breadth of Grimpen Ward within 10 minutes of the time it took you to cure that fat woman innkeeper. Did you think that such a noisy performance would go unnoticed? How do you think it was that you were found by those cutthroats?"
"You knew of that too, then?"
"Healer, you are a fool." She said it kindly, her hand reaching up to touch his cheek. "Rovers are the first to know anything that happens in the places where they travel. If it were not so, they would not long survive. A lesson you apparently have yet to learn. Once word spread of your wondrous act of healing, it was obvious to anyone with half a brain that there would be some who would soon decide that one with your talent must surely be a man of wealth. Greed and drink mix well, healer. You are lucky to be alive."
"I suppose so," he acknowledged, chagrined. "I should have been a bit more careful."
"A bit. Fortunately for you, I realized who you were and prevailed upon Cephalo to let me find you, once the cry went up from the inn. Otherwise, you might be food for the dogs."
"A pleasant thought." Will grimaced. He glanced at her quickly.
"Cephalo knows that I'm here." "He knows." She smiled and the mischievousness returned to her eyes. "Does that frighten you?"
"Let's just say that it concerns me," Will admitted. "Why should he do anything for me after what happened back in the Tearfing?"
Eretria leaned close and put her slim, dark arms about his neck.
Because his daughter is persuasive, healer. Persuasive enough that at times she may influence even so difficult a man as Cephalo. She shrugged. Besides, he has had time to rethink what happened at the Tirfing. I have convinced him, I think, that it was none of your doing, that in fact you saved the lives of the family.
Will shook his head doubtfully.
I don't trust him. Nor should you, she agreed. But for tonight, at least, he should cause you no concern. He will wait until morning to have you answer to him. By then, at any rate, your pursuers will have worn themselves out, chasing shadows, and have gone back again to the taverns for fresh ale and a more tangible source of gain.
She rose then, slipped away in a flash of blue silk, and returned a moment later with a damp cloth and a fresh basin of water, which she placed on the floor next to the bed.
We must clean you up, healer. You reek of sweat and dirt, and your clothes are ruined.
She paused.
Take them off, and I'll wash you.
Will shook his head.
I will wash myself. Can you lend me some clothes? She nodded, but made no move to go.
The veilman flushed.
I would like to do this by myself, if you don't mind.
The dazzling smile broke across her face.
Oh, but I do mind.
He shook his head.
You really are incorrigible. You are for me, Will Ohmsford. I told you that before.
The smile faded, replaced by a look so sensuous and compelling as to cause Will to forget momentarily what it was that he was about. When she started to lean toward him, he forced himself to sit up quickly on the bed. Dizziness washed over him, but he kept himself upright.
Will you bring me the clothes?
For an instant her eyes went dark with anger. Then she rose, crossed to a cupboard, removed some clothing, and brought it to him.
You may have these.
She tossed them in his lap. She started past him, then dipped suddenly and kissed him quickly on the mouth.
Wash and dress yourself, then.
She sniffed, slipping away. She opened a door at the end of the wagon and disappeared into the night, closing the door behind her securely and latching it from without. Will grinned in spite of himself. Whatever her intentions, she was not about to let him run off. Quickly he stripped away his old clothing, washed, and put on the clothes Eretria had supplied. They fit well, though they were the clothes of a rover, and he felt more than a little strange wearing them. He had just finished dressing when the door opened again, and Eretria appeared with Amberlee. The elven girl was dressed in rover pants and tunic, with a sash and headband to hold back her waist-length hair. Her face was freshly scrubbed and a bit startled. She glanced at Will's head, and there was immediate concern in her green eyes.
"Are you all right?" she asked quickly.
"I have seen to his needs." Eretria brushed her question aside smoothly. She pointed to the bed opposite Will's.
"You can sleep there. Be certain that you do not try to leave the wagon tonight."
She gave Will a knowing smile, then turned away and moved to the door. She was halfway through when she glanced back suddenly.
"Good night, Brother Will.
Good night, Sister Amberlee. Sleep well." With a grin, she slipped through the door. The latch fastened behind her with a click. The veilman and the elven girl slept that night within the rover wagon. It was dawn when they awoke, the new light seeping through cracks in the shuttered windows to light the dusky gloom. Will lay silent for a time, gathering his thoughts, waiting for the sleep to clear from his eyes. After a moment, he reached within his tunic for the small leather pouch containing the elf stones, checked to be certain that they were still there, and then replaced the pouch. It did not hurt to be careful, he thought. He was halfway out of the bed when Amberlee ordered him back in again, scrambling up from the other bed to reach him. Carefully she examined the injury to his head and readjusted the bandage.
When she had finished, Will pushed himself up beside her and surprised her with a quick kiss on one cheek. She flushed slightly and smiled, her child's face beaming. A short time later, the door latch released and Eritrea stepped through, carrying a tray of bread, honey, milk, and fruit. Brown limbs slipped from beneath a diaphanous white gown that swirled about the rover girl like smoke. The dazzling smile flashed at the veilman. "Well rested, Will Omsford?" She deposited the tray on his lap and winked. "Cephalo will speak with you now." She left without saying a word to Amberley. Will glanced at the elven girl when Eritrea had gone and shrugged helplessly. Amberley's smile was forced. Minutes later, Cephalo appeared. He entered without knocking, his tall, lean frame stooping slightly as it passed through the entry. Dressed in black and wrapped in the cloak of forest green, he appeared just as he had when they had first observed him on the banks of the Myrmidon. The wide-brimmed hat was cocked jauntily on his head, and he removed it with a flourish as he entered, a broad grin splitting his swarthy face. "Ah, the elflings, the healer and his sister. We meet again." He bowed. "Still looking for your horse?" Will smiled. "Not this time." The rover looked down the length of his hooked nose at them. "No? Have you lost your way, then? Arbalon, as I remember, lies north." "We have been to Arbalon and left again," the veilman replied, setting aside the tray. "Come to Grimp and Ward?"
"Both of us, it seems."
"Indeed." The tall man seated himself opposite the two. "In my case, business takes me many places that I might not otherwise care to go. But what of yourself, healer? What brings you to Grimpen Ward? Surely not the prospect of applying your art to the denizens of so shabby a village as this one." Will hesitated a moment before responding. He was going to have to be very careful what he told Cephalo. He knew the man well enough by now to appreciate the fact that if the rover were to discover anything that he might turn to his own advantage, he would be quick to do so.
"We have business of our own," he replied carelessly.
The rover pursed his lips.
"You do not seem to be doing very well in its pursuit, healer. Your throat would be cut by now if not for me."
Will wanted to laugh aloud. The old fox! He was not about to admit that Eritrea had anything to do with saving them.
"We seem to be in your debt once again," he offered.
Cephalo shrugged.
"I was hasty in my judgment of you at the Tirfing. I let my concern for my people override my common sense. I blamed you for what happened when I should have thanked you for aiding. That has bothered me. Saving you now eases my sense of guilt."
"I am gratified to learn that you feel this way."
Will did not believe one word of it.
"This has been a difficult time for my sister and me."
"Difficult?" Cephalo's dark face mirrored sudden concern.
"Perhaps there is something more that I can do to aid you. Something to be of service. If you would tell me what it is exactly that brings you to this most dangerous part of the country."
Here it comes, Will thought. Out of the corner of his eye, he watched Amberley frown in warning.
"I wish that it were within your power to help."
Will did his best to sound sincere.
"But I'm afraid that it is not. What I need most is the guidance of someone familiar with the history of this valley, its marks and its legends."
Cephalo clapped his hands lightly.
"Well then, perhaps I can be of assistance after all. I have traveled the Wilderun many times."
He lifted a long finger to the side of his head.
"I know something of its secrets." "Perhaps," Will thought, "perhaps not. He wants to know what we are doing here."
The Veilman shrugged.
I do not feel that we should impose further on your hospitality by involving you in our affairs. My sister and I can manage.
The rover's face was expressionless.
Why not tell me what it is that brings you here? Let me judge if the imposition is so great.
Amberley's hand closed tightly on Will's arm, but he ignored it, keeping his eyes locked on Cephalo's. He knew that he was going to have to tell the rover something.
There is a sickness within the house of the Illicitals, rulers of the elves.
He lowered his voice.
The king's granddaughter is very ill. The medicine she needs is an extract from a root that can only be found here within the Wilderun. I alone know that, I and my sister. We have come here in search of that root, for if we can find it and carry it to the elven ruler, the reward will be great.
He felt Amberley's grip loosen abruptly. He did not dare to look at her face.
Cephalo was silent for a moment before replying. Do you know where within the Wilderun this root can be found?
The Veilman nodded.
There are books, ancient books of healing from the old world, that speak of the root and the name of its location. But it is a name long since forgotten, long since erased from the maps that serve the races now. I doubt that the name would mean anything to you.
The rover leaned forward.
Tell it to me anyway. Safehold, Will declared, watching the other's dark face. The name is Safehold.
Cephalo thought a moment, then shook his head.
You were right. The name means nothing. Still,
he paused deliberately, rocking back slightly as if deep in thought.
There is one who might know the name, one familiar with the old names of this valley. I could lead you to him, I suppose.
Ah, but healer, the Wilderun is very dangerous country.
You know that yourself, since you most certainly crossed through some small part of its forests to reach Grimpen Ward. The risk to my people and myself if we were to aid you in such a perilous search would be great.
He shrugged apologetically.
Besides, we have other commitments, other places to which we must travel, other business to which we must attend. Time is a precious thing to such as we.
Surely you can appreciate that.
What is it that you are saying? The Veilman demanded quietly. That without me you will fail in your quest, that you need me, that I in turn wish to offer my help.
But such help as you seek cannot be given without adequate recompense. Will nodded slowly.
What recompense, Cephalo?
The rover's eyes glittered.
The stones you carry, the ones that hold the power.
The Veilman shook his head.
They would be useless to you. Would they? Is their secret so dark?
Cephalo's eyes narrowed.
Do not suppose me a fool. You are no simple healer. That much was obvious almost from the moment we first met. Still, it matters not to me who you are, only what you have.
You have the power of the stones, and I wish it.
Their magic is elven.
Will forced himself to remain calm, hoping desperately that he had not lost control of the situation.
Only one of elven blood can wield their power.
You lie badly, healer. The big man's voice was ugly.
He speaks the truth, Amberley interjected quickly, her face frightened. If not for the stones, he would not have even attempted this search. You have no right to ask him to give them up to you.
I have the right to ask whatever I choose, Cephalo snapped, brushing her words aside with a wave of his hand.
In any case, I believe neither of you.
Believe what you wish. Will's voice was steady. I will not give you the stones. The two men stared wordlessly at each other for a moment, the rover's face hard and threatening. Yet there was fear there as well, fear generated by Cephalo's vivid memory of the power locked within the Elfstones, power that Will Ohmsford had mastered. With great effort, he forced himself to smile.
What will you give me then, healer? Am I expected to do this service for nothing? Am I expected to risk lives and property without any form of recompense at all? There must be something of value that you can give me, something that has worth equal to that of the stones you so stubbornly refuse to yield. What, then? What will you give me?
Will tried desperately to come up with something, but there was absolutely nothing else he carried that was worth more than a few pennies. Yet just when he had decided that the situation was hopeless, Cephalo snapped his fingers sharply.
I will make a bargain with you, healer. You say that the Elven King will reward you if you bring to him the medicine that will cure his granddaughter.
Very well.
I will do what I can to help you learn something of this place you call Safehold. I will take you to one who might know the name. I will do that, and nothing more. In exchange for this, you must give me half of whatever reward you receive from the Elven King.
Half. Is it agreed?
Will thought it over a moment. A curious bargain, he decided. Rovers seldom, if ever, gave anything away without first getting something in return. What was Cephalo about?
Are you saying that you will help me learn the location of Safehold?
If I can.
But you will not come with me to find it?
Cephalo shrugged. I have no wish to risk my life unnecessarily. Finding the medicine and conveying it to the Elven King's granddaughter is your problem. My part of the bargain is merely to help you on your way.
He paused.
Do not, however, presume that once gone you are therefore free of me. Any attempt to cheat me of what you owe would end very badly for you.
The Veilman frowned.
How will you know whether or not I am successful if you do not come with me?
Cephalo laughed.
Healer, I am a rover. I will know all that happens to you, believe me.
His smile was so wolfish that for an instant Will was certain that there was another meaning to his words. Something was wrong. He could sense it. Yet they needed help from somewhere in finding their way through the Wilderun. Help that would permit him to forego any use of the Elfstones. If Cephalo were to give them that help, it might mean the difference between success and failure in finding the Bloodfire before the demons found them.
Is it agreed? Cephalo asked again.
Will shook his head. He would test the rover.
One half is too much. I will give you a third.
A third? Cephalo's face darkened momentarily, then relaxed.
Very well. I am a reasonable man. A third.
That had been entirely too easy, Will thought. He glanced at Amberlee, seeing in her eyes the same mistrust that flickered in his own. But the elven girl said nothing. She was leaving the decision to him.
Come, come, elfling, Cephalo pressed. Do not be all day about it.
The Veilman nodded.
All right. It is agreed.
Good. The rover stood up immediately. We will leave at once, since our business here is ended. But you are to remain within the wagon for a time. It would not do to have you seen again in Grimpen Ward. Once we are into the deep forest, you may come out.
He smiled broadly, dipped the wide-brimmed hat in parting, and passed back through the entry. The door closed softly behind him, and locked. Will and Amberley sat staring at each other.
"I don't trust him," Amberley whispered.
Will nodded.
"Not at all."
Moments later, the wagon lurched forward and began to roll, and their journey into the Wilderun was underway once more.
Chapter 37. The old man hummed softly to himself as he sat in the cane-backed rocker and stared out into the darkening forest. Far to the west, beyond the wall of trees that locked tightly about the clearing in which he sat, beyond the valley of the Wilderun and the mountains that ringed it, the sun slipped beneath the earth's horizon and the day's light faded into dusk. It was the old man's favorite time of day, the midday heat cooling into evening shadow, the sunset coloring the far skyline crimson and purple, then deepening into blue night. From atop the ridgeline, where the woodland trees broke apart enough to permit glimpses of sky, moon, and stars through a screen of limbs and trunks, the air smelled clean for a time, freed of the damp and mustiness that clung to it through the swelter of the day, and the leaves of the forest whispered in a soft, slow nighttime wind. It was as if, for those few moments, the Wilderun were like any other country, and a man might look upon it as an old and intimate friend. The old man looked often upon the valley that way, more now than at any other time of the day or night, perhaps, but always with that same sense of deep and abiding loyalty. Few others could ever feel as he, but few others knew the valleys as he had come to know it. Oh, it was treacherous. Hard and filled with dangers to snare and destroy a man. There were creatures within the Wilderun the like of which could be found in no other place this side of a midnight campfire legend, told with hushed whispers and frightened looks. There was death here, death that came with the passing of every hour, harsh, cruel, and certain. It was a land of hunter and hunted, each living creature a bit of both, and the old man had seen the best and worst of each in the 60 years that he had made the valley his home. He drummed his fingers on the rocker's arms and thought back dreamily. It was 60 years since he had first come to the Wilderun. A long time, yet barely gone. This had been his home for all those years, and it was a home that a man could respect. Not simply another place with houses and people all crowded close, safe, secure, and senselessly dull, but a place of solitude and depth, of challenge and heart, a place to which only a few would ever come because only those few would ever belong. A few like himself, he thought. And now only he remained of those who had once come into the valley. All the rest were gone, claimed by the wilderness, buried somewhere deep within her earth. Of course there were those fools that huddled like frightened dogs within the ragged shacks of Grimp and Ward, cheating and robbing each other and any other fool that might venture into their midst. But the valley was not theirs, and never would be, for they had no understanding of what the valley was about, nor any wish to learn. They might as well be locked within the closet of some castle for all it meant to any claim that they were its lords and ladies. Crazy, they called him. Those fools in Grimp and Ward. Crazy to live in this wilderness, an old man alone. He grinned crookedly at the thought. Madness peculiar to its owner, perhaps, but he would choose his own over theirs. Drifter, he called gruffly, and the monstrous black dog that stretched his feet came awake and rose, a giant animal that had the look of both wolf and bear, its massive body bristling with hair, its muzzle yawning wide.
Hey, you!
The old man grunted, and the dog came over, dropping its great head onto its master's lap, waiting for its ears to be scratched. The old man obliged. Somewhere in the growing dark, a scream sounded, quick and piercing, to linger in the sudden stillness as a fading echo, then die. Drifter looked up quickly. The old man nodded. swamp cat. A big one. Something had crossed its path and paid the price. His gaze wandered idly, picking out familiar shapes and forms in the half-light. Behind him sat the hut in which he lived, a small but solid structure, built of logs and shingles caulked with mortar. A shed and well sat just back of the hut, and a fenced closure that held his mule, and a workbench and lumber. He liked to whittle and carve, liked it well enough that much of his day was spent shaping and honing the wood he took from the great trees about the clearing into odds and ends that it pleased him to look upon. Worthless, he supposed, to everyone but himself. But then he didn't care much about anyone else, so that was all right. He saw little enough of people, and little enough was more than enough, and he didn't look to give them reasons to seek him out. Drifter was all the company he needed. And those worthless cats that wandered about looking for new places to sleep and table scraps as if they were no better than common scavengers. And the mule, a dumb but dependable creature. He stretched and rose. The sun was down and the night sky was laced with stars and moonlight. It was time to fix something to eat for himself and the dog. He looked momentarily toward the tripod and kettle which sat atop a small cooking fire several hundred yards in front of him. Yesterday's soup, and precious little of that. Enough, maybe, for one more meal. He moved toward the fire, shaking his head. He was a smallish man, old and bent, his stick-thin frame clothed in a ragged shirt and half-pants. White hair ringed his bald head in a thin fringe of snow that ran down the length of a roundish jaw to a beard spotted with soot and bits of sawdust. Brown, wrinkled skin covered his tough old body like leather, and his eyes were barely visible through lids that pouched and drooped. He walked with a sort of hunching motion as if he had just come awake and, finding his muscles cramped with sleep, was attempting to work out the stiffness. He halted beside the kettle and stared down into it, trying to decide what he might do to improve the appeal of its contents. It was at that moment that he heard the approach of the horses and wagon, distant still, lost in the dark somewhere up the trail from his hut, winding uncertainly toward him. He turned and stared into the night, waiting. At his side, Drifter growled in an unfriendly manner, and the old man gave him a warning cuff. The minutes slipped away, and the sounds drew closer. Finally, a line of shadows emerged from the dusk, winding down over the crest of the rise fronting the clearing. A single wagon with horses in trace, and half a dozen riders in tow. The old man's mood soured the moment he saw the wagon. He knew it well enough. Knew it to be Rover, knew it to belong to that rogue Cephalo. He spat to one side with distaste and thought seriously about loosing Drifter on the bunch of them. The riders and wagon halted just inside the fringes of the clearing. Cephalo's dark form dismounted and came forward. When he reached the old man, the Rover's wide-brimmed hat swept down in greeting. "Well met, Hebel. Good evening to you." The old man snorted. "Cephalo, what do you want?" Cephalo looked shocked.
Hebel, this is no greeting for two who have done as much for one another as we. This is no greeting for men who have shared the hardships and misfortunes of humankind. Hello now."
The Rover took the old man's hand and shook it firmly. Hebel neither resisted nor aided the effort.
"Ah, you look well."
Cephalo smiled disarmingly.
"The high country is good for the aches and pains of age, I imagine."
"Aches and pains of age, is it?" Hebel spat and wrinkled his nose. "What are you selling, Cephalo? Some cure-all for the infirm?" Cephalo glanced back at those who had come with him and shrugged apologetically.
"You are most unkind, Hebel. Most unkind."
The old man followed his gaze.
"What have you done with the rest of your pack? Have they taken up with some other thief?"
This time the rover's face darkened slightly. I have sent them on ahead. They follow the main roadway east to await my coming in the Tirfing. I am here with these few on a matter of some importance. Might we talk a bit?
You're here, aren't you? Hebel pointed out. Talk all you want.
And share your fire.
Hebel shrugged.
I don't have the food to feed you all.
Wouldn't if I did.
Maybe you brought something with you, huh?
Cephalo gave an exaggerated sigh.
We did. Tonight you shall share our dinner.
He called back to the others. The riders dismounted and began caring for the horses. An old woman had been driving the wagon in the company of a young couple. She climbed down now, removed provisions and cookware from the rear of the wagon, and shuffled wordlessly to the cooking fire. The two who sat with her hesitated momentarily, then came forward at Cephalo's invitation. They were joined by a slim, dark-haired girl who had been one of the riders. Hebel turned away wordlessly and reseated himself in the rocker. There was something peculiar about the two who had come down off the wagon seat, but he could not quite put his finger on what it was. They looked like rovers, and yet at the same time they didn't. He watched them approach with Cephalo and the dark-haired girl. All four seated themselves on the grass about the old man, the dark-haired girl slipping suggestively close to the young man and giving him a bold wink. "My daughter, Eritrea." Cephalo shot the girl an irritated look as he introduced her. "These two are elves."
"I'm not blind," Hebel snapped, recognizing now why they appeared to be something more than rovers. "What are they doing with you?"
"We have undertaken a quest," the rover announced. Hebel leaned forward.
"A quest? With you?"
He glanced at the young man, his aged face wrinkling.
"You seem like a bright sort. What made you decide to take up with him?"
"He requires a guide through this miserable country," Cephalo answered for him. Rather too quickly, Hebel thought. "Why is it, Hebel, that you insist on making this forsaken wilderness your home? One day I'll pass by and find your bones, old man, and all because you were too stubborn to take your worthless hide to safer regions."
"Much you'd care," Hebel grunted. "For a man such as myself, this land is as safe as any other."
"I know it. Know what walks and breathes and hunts it. Know how to keep my distance and when to show my teeth."
"I'll outlive you, Rover. Mark my words on that."
He pushed back in the rocker, watching Drifter's dark shadow settle in behind him.
"What do you want with me?"
Cephalo shrugged. "A bit of talk, just as I've said." Hebel laughed hoarsely.
"A bit of talk? Come now, Cephalo, what do you want? Don't waste my time. There isn't that much of it left."
"For myself, nothing. For these young elflings, something of the knowledge stored in that balding old pate. It has taken me a great deal of effort to reach you up here, but there are causes that merit special..."
Hebel had heard enough. "What are you cooking over there?"
He allowed himself to be distracted by the smell of the food simmering in the cooking kettle.
"What's in there?"
"How should I know?" Cephalo snapped, irritated by the old man's seeming inattention.
"Beef, I think. Beef and vegetables."
Hebel rubbed his weathered hands.
"I think we should eat before we talk. Got some of that rover ale with you, Cephalo?"
So they ate plates of stew, day-old bread, dried fruits and nuts, with glasses of ale to wash it all down. Not much was said while they ate, though a considerable number of glances were exchanged, and those glances told Hebel a good deal more about the situation than whatever words his visitors might have spoken. The elves, he decided, were there because they had run out of choices in the matter. They cared nothing more for Cephalo and his band than he did. Cephalo, of course, was there because there was something in all of this for him. But what that might be would undoubtedly be kept carefully concealed.
It was the dark-haired girl, the rover's daughter, who puzzled him most. The way she looked at that elf lad told him something of what she was about, yet there was more to her than that, more than she was willing to let on. The old man grew increasingly curious as to what it might be. At last the food was gone and the ale was drunk. Heble produced a long pipe, struck flint and tinder to its contents, and puffed a broad wreath of smoke into the night air. Cephalo tried again. "This young elf and his sister need your help. They have already come a long way, but they won't be able to go any further if you don't give them that help. I told them, of course, that you would." The old man snorted. He knew this game. "Don't like elves. They think they're too good for this country, for people like me." He lifted one eyebrow. "Don't like rovers either, as you well know. Like them even less than elves." Eretria smirked. "There seems to be a lot you don't like." "Shut your mouth," Cephalo snapped, his face darkening. Eretria went still, and Heble saw the anger in her eyes. He chuckled softly. "Oh, I don't blame you, Go." He looked at Cephalo. "What will you give me if I help the elflings, Rover? An even trade now, if you want what I know." Cephalo glowered. "Do not try my patience too severely, Heble." "Ha! Will you cut my throat? See what words you find then. Now speak again. What will you give me?" "Clothes, bedding, leather, silk, I don't care." The rover brushed aside the question stiffly. "I got all that." Heble spat. Cephalo controlled himself only with a monumental effort. "Well, what is it that you want, then? Speak up, old man." From behind the rocker, Drifter growled in warning. Heble reached back and gave the dog a cuff. "Knives," he announced. "Half a dozen good blades, an axe head and wedges, 2 dozen arrows, ashwood and feathered, and a cutting stone." The big man nodded, looking less than pleased. "Done, thief. Now give me something back for all that." Heble shrugged. "What is it you want to know?" Cephalo pointed at the young man. "The elfling is a healer. He looks for a root that produces a rare medicine. His books of healing say that it can be found here, within the Wilderun, in the place called Safehold." There was a long moment of silence as the rover and the old man stared at each other, and the others waited. "Well?" Cephalo demanded finally. "Well, what?" the old man snapped. "Safehold. Where is it?" Heble grinned crookedly. "Right where it's always been, I imagine." He saw the surprise in the other's face. "I know the name, Rover. An old name, forgotten by everyone but me, I'd guess. Tombs of some sort. Catacombs beneath a mountain." "That's it." The young man came to his feet, his face flushed. Then he saw that everyone was staring at him, and he sat down again quickly. "At least that is the way that the books described it," he added lamely. "Did they now?" Heble rocked back, puffing. "Did they speak as well of the hollows?" The young man shook his head and glanced at the elf girl, who shook her head as well. It was Cephalo who leaned forward sharply, his eyes narrowing. "You mean that Safehold lies within the hollows, old man?" There was an edge to Cephalo's voice that did not escape Heble. Cephalo was frightened. Heble chuckled. "Within the hollows. Do you still seek Safehold, Rover?" The young man hunched forward. "Where can the hollows be found?" "South, a day's walk," the old man answered. It was time to put an end to this foolishness. "Deep and dark they are, elfling, a pit in which anything that drops falls from sight and is lost forever.
death, Elfling. Nothing that goes into the hollows comes out again. Those who live there choose to keep it so.
The young man shook his head.
I do not understand.
Eretria muttered something under her breath, her eyes darting quickly to the face of the young elf.
She knew, Hebel saw.
His voice dropped to a whisper.
The witch sisters, Elfling. Morag and Malinro. The hollows belong to them and to the things they make to serve them. Things of witch power.
But where within the hollows lies Safehold, the other persisted. You spoke of a mountain.
Spire's Reach, a solitary peak that rises up out of the hollows like an arm stretched forth from death's grave. There lies Safehold.
The old man paused, shrugging.
Or so it was once. I have not been to the hollows myself in many, many years.
He shook his head.
No one goes there anymore.
The young man nodded slowly.
Tell me something of these witch sisters.
Hebel's eyes narrowed.
Morag and Malinro. The last of their kind. Once, Elfling, there were many such as they. Now there are but two. Some say they were the handmaidens of the warlock lord. Some say they were here long before even he. Power to match that of the druids, some say.
He spread his hands.
The truth is hidden with them. Seek it if you wish. The loss of another elf, more or less, means nothing to me.
He laughed sharply, choking a bit until he lifted his cup and drank down a swallow or two of ale. His thin frame bent forward as he sought the young man's eyes.
Sisters they are, Morag and Malinro, blood sisters. But there is a great hate between them, a hate from some wrong suffered long ago. Real or imagined, I could not say, nor anyone else, I'd guess. But they war within the hollows, Elfling. Morag holds the east, Malinro the west, each trying to destroy the other, each trying to seize for herself her sister's land and power. And at the center of the hollows, just between the two, stands Spire's Reach. And there, Safehold.
Have you seen Safehold?
I? Not I. The hollows belong to the sisters. The valley is room enough for me.
Hebel rocked back, remembering.
Once, so many years ago that I no longer care to count, I hunted along the rim of the hollows. Foolish it was, but I was still of a mind to know the whole of the land that I had chosen for my own. And the stories were but stories. For days I hunted within the shadow of the hollows, seeing nothing. Then one night as I slept, alone but for the dimming embers of my campfire, she came to me. Malinro, tall and like some creature from a dream, grey hair long and woven with nightshade, a face, the face of Mistress Death. She came to me, told me she felt the need to speak to one of human blood, one such as I. All the rest of the night she talked and told me of herself and her sister Morag and of the war they fought to own the hollows.
He was lost in the memory now, his voice distant and soft.
In the morning she was gone, almost as if she had never been. I never saw her again, of course, not from that moment to this. I might have thought it all imagined, not real at all, except that she took some part of me with her, some bit of life, I suppose you'd say.
He shook his head slowly.
Most of what she told me scattered like the fragments of some dream. But I remember her words of Safehold, Elfling. Catacombs beneath the arm of Spire's Reach, she said. A place from another age where some strange magic had once been done.
so old it was that even the sisters did not know its meaning. She told me that, did Malinroe. I remember that much, at least. He was silent then, thinking back on what had been. Even after all these years, the memory of her was as clear as the faces of those who sat about him. Malinroe. Strange, he thought, that he should remember her so well. The young man was speaking quietly, his hand touching the edge of the rocker. You remember enough, Hebel. The old man looked at the elf in surprise, not understanding. Then he saw in the other's eyes what he intended. He meant to go there, Hebel realized. He meant to go into the hollows. Impulsively, he leaned down. Do not go, he whispered, his head shaking slowly. Do not go. The young man smiled faintly. I must, if Cephalo is to have his reward. The rover said nothing, his dark face inscrutable. Eretria glanced sharply at him, then turned back to the young man. Healer, do not do this, she begged. Listen to what the old man has said. The hollows are no place for you. Seek your medicine elsewhere. The elf shook his head. There is nowhere else. Let it alone, Eretria. For an instant, the rover girl's entire body seemed to go taut, her dark face flushing with emotions that struggled to break free. Yet she held them carefully in check, rising to her feet and staring down at him coldly. You are a fool, she announced, and stalked away into the dark. Hebel watched the young man, saw his eyes follow after Eretria as she went from them. The elven girl did not look, her strange green eyes introspective and all but lost in the shadow of her long hair as it fell forward about her child's face. Is this root so important? The old man asked wonderingly, not just to the young man but to the girl as well. Can it not be found another place? Let them be. Cephalo spoke up suddenly, his dark eyes slipping from face to face. The decision is theirs to make, and they have made it. Hebel frowned. So quick to send them to their deaths, Rover. What then of this reward of which the elfling speaks? Cephalo laughed. Rewards are given and taken away by the whims of fortune, old man. Where one is lost, another is gained. The elfling must do what he chooses, he and his sister. We have no right to pass judgment. We have to go. The elven girl spoke softly for the first time since they had been seated, looking deep into the old man's eyes. Well, then, Cephalo rose. Enough said of the matter. The evening is not yet done, and there is good rover ale to be drunk. Share it with me, friends. We shall talk of the times that have been, rather than guess at what might yet be. Hebel, you shall hear what those fools that people Grimp and Ward have done of late. Madness the like of which only men such as you and I can truly appreciate. He called sharply to the old woman, who scurried to his side with a flask of ale. Several more of the rovers drifted over to join them, and Cephalo poured freely from the flask into the cups of all. Laughing and joking, he began a series of wild-eyed stories of places he had probably never been, and people he had certainly never met. Bold and easy was the rover, his talk filling the night with the laughter of his people and the clink of their glasses raised in salute. Hebel listened with distrust. Cephalo had been too quick to disparage his warning to the elflings and to disclaim interest in the supposed reward that would come, it seemed, only if the young elf found the medicine he sought and returned again. Too quick by far, he thought, for the rover knew as well as he that no one had ever returned from the hollows. He rocked slowly in his cane-backed chair, one hand dropping idly to find Drifter's shaggy head. What more warning could he give this elf, he wondered?
What could he say that he had not already said to discourage his foolishness? Perhaps nothing. The lad seemed determined that he must go. He wondered then if the elfling would meet Malinroe as he had done so many years ago. Thinking that he might, he envied him. It was a short time later when Will Ohmsford rose from the company of revelers and walked to the well that sat just back of the old man's hut. Amberley already slept, wrapped in blankets close to the fire, exhausted, it seemed, from the day's journey and the events leading up to it. He also was experiencing an unusual drowsiness, though he had drunk little of the Rover ale. The cold water might help, he thought, and a good night's sleep after. He had just taken a long drink from a metal cup hooked to the well bucket's chain when Eretria stepped from the shadows to stand before him.
"I do not understand you, healer," she said bluntly.
He replaced the cup within the bucket and seated himself on the stone wall of the well. This was Eretria's first appearance since she had called him a fool in front of the others.
"I went to a considerable amount of trouble to save your life back in Grimpen Ward," she continued. "It was not easy persuading Cephalo that he should allow me to help you. Not easy at all. Now it seems that my efforts were wasted. I might as well have let those cutthroats have you, you and this elven girl you pretend is your sister. Despite the warnings you have been given, you insist on going into the Hollows. I want to know why. Has Cephalo anything to do with this? I don't know what bargain you struck with him, but nothing he promised, even if he were of a mind to deliver, which I doubt he is.